Hey girl, welcome to the Empower Her podcast, where we are all about taking purpose-driven action toward building lives we really freaking love. My name's Keisha, and I'm a saucy 29-year-old who left the corporate world to go on to build a 7-figure online business. But most days, I still feel like I have no clue what I'm doing, but I'm obsessed with the process of us getting to figure it out together. We've got epic guests, incredible stories, tips, and tricks to help us get out of our own way and unapologetically make some moves. So girlfriend, let's do the damn thing. Girl, I'm so excited that you're here. And honestly, I'm kind of geeking out over today's guest because she's so incredible. Her name is Dr. Sasha Hines. She's a development psychologist and life coach. She's an expert in positive psychology, lasting behavioral change, and the science of getting unstuck. She received her BA from Harvard, her PhD in development psychology from Columbia, and her master's in applied positive psychology from UPenn, where she also served as a faculty member. Why am I telling you this? Obviously, it's super impressive in terms of her career in academia, but she also has this really incredible skill set to develop interpersonal relationships, and she's got a really great way of explaining technical science-based jargon in simplistic terms that makes you feel like you're friends with her, which is so powerful because she gives data and tangible tips and tools about getting unstuck and building lives that we love and how to actually train our brains to cognitively change and adapt so that we can live a life we're obsessed with. This interview is one of my favorites so far. I cannot wait to hear what you think. And without further ado, I'm just going to turn the time over to Sasha. Let's do this. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm so excited that you're here today, Sasha.
Me too. So happy to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be so fun. You have a crazy, amazing backstory and education and everything that you've done and the work that you're doing in the world, I think is going to be super impactful to this audience. And before we dive into kind of some of the mindset around getting unstuck and all of the stuff that we're going to dig into, I need to know the backstory because this is kind of crazy that you're in this field now, right? Like, give us kind of the backstory of how you pursued the education path that you did. Why? Like, give us your rundown so we can know a little more about you.
It was never meant to happen this way. not at all. It's so funny. Now it's kind of like more mainstream. And so it doesn't seem so weird. Like, I was just with my husband on a trip the other weekend and I was talking about how I'm a coach and it seems so normal. I'm like, when I started out with this, it was so not normal.
Yeah.
It was a real fringe career.
Yeah. Especially being like in an Ivy League education. I won't tell your story for you. You tell your story, but yeah, explain the backstory.
Well, I mean, my education, I grew up on the East Coast, like all over the East Coast. I've lived basically everywhere north of from Washington, D.C., where I was born, like up to New Hampshire. And education and where you went to school was so important. Yeah. I live west now. I live out west. So it's not, I don't know, it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
But when you live in the East Coast, there's like, you know, where you go to school is immensely important. So I think like my first really big, you know, big bodacious goal in my life was that I was going to Harvard and it was Harvard or bust.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, straight up.
Yeah.
That's where I was going to go. Nothing was going to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Harvard and then when I got there, I had that moment where I realized I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life, who I was, what I liked. My entire life had been to get to Harvard. And then once I got there, I kind of lost my raison d'etre. Like I lost the structure of my life because Harvard had been getting there. That goal had structured everything. It was the goal that made my life make sense.
Yeah.
And then once I got there and I'm supposed to be, you know, a pig in slop, like so happy I just achieved like the big goal. Yay me. And I was ecstatic and happy for, you know, like a week.
Yeah.
Maybe longer, but it didn't last long. Like say months, I was like, this is amazing. So happy to go to school. And then, but then what happens is like, now I realize, it's called hedonic adaptation. Your brain just adapts to the new normal, which is now I'm going to an Ivy League school. And so it didn't seem as exciting anymore. And, you know,
yeah.
And also I didn't have you know, that external goal that was structuring my life. So then I felt so lost and so just confused about, you know, what I want to do with my life. And also was dealing with terrible eating disorder, which I'm very open about. But yeah. And so my life really kind of unraveled in college, which ultimately now I think was like a great thing, because I wouldn't be have the career that I do today if that hadn't happened.
Well, and you wouldn't be able to say I understand it to from my lens, like where you're coming from, because I've been in a similar situation in my life to mm-hmm. people that you're talking to that feel that way all the time, I'm guessing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody, we all have our hard curriculum. Everybody has their thing that they go through that's challenging for them and difficult. And when we begin to see it as something that's happening, you know, even this extremely painful things, and there are like, you know, some really painful things that happened, when you can begin to do, like, you get to this place where you can see it happening for you. I mean, it sounds so glib.
Yep.
And it doesn't feel good at all. Like, if you're in the middle of your suffering right now, like, this is not going to feel, this is, you're going to want to roll your eyes or do something worse to me. But, like, I would like to give you the finger right now. But it really, like, you, when, because when you begin to see your life in retrospect, like, you can see how all of these things work together to create something better.
Oh yeah.
Help you get to a deeper understanding of who you are and like plumb the depths, like a deeper level of
yeah.
life.
And yeah. Actually one of the most popular episodes on this podcast is one that I did solo about life being rigged in your favor, with that same mentality of like, it's so freaking hard when you're in it. But mm-hmm. when you look back, you can kind of connect the dots, like you're doing right now, even in your story of like, it sucked when I got there and I arrived. I'm like, ugh, I don't, you know, I don't want this. Like, I got here and now I don't know what to do, but look what you've made of it. So sorry, continue on of like,
well, no,
your
I mean,
Harvard.
Like, and you know, yeah. you know, what's so interesting is that I, for years after college, I held this, idea that like I had wasted my time in college and that I missed out on this like magical time and it should have been better than it was, blah, blah, blah. Like I had all these thoughts, none of which made me feel very good. Right. They all made me feel terrible about my past, which is no bueno, because it can't change my past, right? So mm-hmm. I can't change my past, but I can change my relationship to my past. So, but for years I had this, you know, feel like I really wasted this time. But in some ways now I realize like, you know what, having college not be the best years of my life, like actually freed me to always believe that the best years of my life are ahead of me, which is such a much more fun thought.
Yeah.
Like I'd so much rather have the best years be ahead of me, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to have a life where I look back and I'm like, oh
yeah.
The best years of my life.
You peaked doing a keg stand at 21 or something.
Right. Right.
That's
exactly.
Amazing. So mm-hmm. how at Harvard, like why Harvard, and then how the positive psychology, like where did that come from?
Mm-hmm. So why Harvard was very simple. Both my parents had met at Harvard. My mom was in like one of the last Radcliffe classes to graduate from Radcliffe. And so I don't know if you've seen this movie called Love Story, but anyway, Ally McGraw is mm-hmm. a classic from the 60s.
Okay.
Anyhow, I had this like whole thing that this is going to be my life. And I always, you know, I think we went out to visit the campus maybe when I was 12 and it was just like, this is where I want to go to school.
Yeah.
Which is also a completely insane thing to believe, because the likelihood of getting in is
so small. High, yeah.
Right. I was naive, you know, like anyone who has a big goal, like there's an element of hubris in the goal setting. Cause you're like, I'm going to achieve this really big thing, which is probably fairly unlikely, but you're just going to go after it. And yeah. even the going after it, even if you don't actually achieve that, like you're going to get so much farther, right?
Yep.
You're going to open so many more doors for yourself anyhow, which is the reason why we all should be goal setters. But anyway, I just was like, I just had it in my head. Like, this is where I wanted to go. And everything in my life was oriented to that. Like the things I decided to do for, you know, the summer, the sports I play, like all of it was really intentional, like how am I going to get, which is, you know, yeah. anyway, good nor bad, it's just the way it was.
Yeah.
But then again, when I got there, I think I really felt like, I don't even know what I'm interested in. Like I'm at this great academic institution and I have no idea what my intellectual interests even are.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're young and you're like, what? Someone tell me what to do.
I was so young. And so, you know, then I did a lot of, I mean, a lot of sort of wacky things. But then I started getting interested in, I was a social anthropology major, and I wanted to do documentary filmmaking. So I did my senior, you do like a senior thesis, but my senior project was on Christian motorcycle ministries. So I did a film on Christian motorcycle ministries, and I spent
Whoa.
Like 9 months traveling to and with like different, motorcycle gangs, and they were ex-outlaw bikers. So they'd been in either like the Hells Angels or the Bandidos, and they'd had like a spiritual awakening and had started their own sort of like Christian version of an outlaw biking gang.
Whoa.
Really fascinating subculture. So I was like in my little like Acura, like sedan rental car.
And they can't, driving to, like, I can still- only imagine just like you being in some really weird situations.
Yes, it was very, I was really anxious pretty much the entire time, but I met some really wonderful people and a lot of people who took great care of me. And were just so open and kind. And it was, I've always been fascinated in subcultures and understanding why people do what they do. I mean, I just think human beings are endlessly fascinating, and what people geek out to and what they love and what they're passionate about. Like, it's so interesting. Like, for someone it's like, it's Ming Dynasty porcelain. And for another it's, like fixing up a Harley. But there is a whole culture to, there's an interesting culture that,
right,
that goes on at these biker rallies. But I was, I was 21 maybe. I don't even know. 21, 22 with my little camera in my rental car.
Oh my gosh. So even back then you knew that you were interested in like the psychology of why people do the things that they do.
Yes. I didn't know. I couldn't have articulated it like that, but yes, I've always been fascinated in what drives people, what motivates people, in like this sort of social dynamic of, so like this in that world is about like social hierarchy and all sorts of interesting things, but like what drives people has always been interesting to me.
So what is like, so then you ended up being so fast forward after you graduate Harvard, then what happens?
So then I kind of took this interest in filmmaking and ran with it, and worked after college. I worked with a lot of production companies and was working freelance, and one job would lead to the other. Then I turned 25 and needed my own, needed to be off my parents' health insurance, because I was doing freelance and they did not, and there was no health insurance, freelance work. So I then decided that, I'm getting kicked off of my parents. I'm no longer a dependent on my parents' health insurance plan. So I needed to get a real job, like at a corporate job.
Yeah.
So I got a job at an advertising agency and worked in production. So we were producing film. Producing advertising.
Okay.
Advertisements.
Yeah. And then how'd the positive psychology you were one of 33 people. What's the statistic? One of 33 people to get, or the first class to get this degree?
The first class to get a degree in positive psychology in history, actually, which is so.
That's really cool. Yeah, they should give you like a trophy for that, because I just feel like that's fun.
I'm already getting my medal. really, really cool. And by that, so what was sort of, here's the parallel, here was going on. So here I am like out of college and I'm working in production and all of that's interesting, and their first job. So it's a lot of like grunt work, and everyone's had these jobs before, right?
Yeah.
They're so important, but not that glamorous. But what I was doing outside of work was I was going through this 12-step program for my eating disorder, and I started working with a coach, and that changed my life.
Yeah.
It changed my life. So I had my day job, and then I had like my passion stuff that I was doing outside of work, which was, all of a sudden I got into like self-development and, self-help. This is all very new to me.
Yeah.
I was like, there wasn't a lot of, WASPs are not well known for their communication skills, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, there's not a lot of open talk, and there's not like there wasn't going to therapists. Like, you just don't do that. So this was all very new to me. I had seen a therapist while I was in college. But this approach, like working with someone who was actively saying, you can create your life. What do you want it to look like? What are you interested in? What do you want to do? And we were focusing on that as opposed to, and by the way, I was doing that in conjunction with seeing a therapist who was also working on like,
yeah,
you know, the why and the why it happened and how different patterns had developed and how I had internalized different, you know, ideas about who I was supposed to be and my, the dynamics in my family, et cetera.
Yeah.
And kind of working through a lot of that. So, but as someone who'd been an athlete, I really loved the approach of the future orientedness of,
yeah,
coaching.
Of coaching. Yeah. Versus yeah, like looking like, back, like with a therapist, looking more back to your childhood, yeah, and stuff. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Like I got this idea of like, wait, I can train to be better at something. And in this case, being better at living, being better at life.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm into this. It's a good, you know, I was really in, and it was about like, what are you going to do today to feel proud of yourself today? Like, what are you, how are you going to live for your future self today?
Yeah.
Like blew my mind.
Yeah, so powerful. What did your like parents think about you like this field?
I mean, I think honestly, well, I'll tell you exactly what. So I think at this point, my parents were really happy that I was just doing better and was, yeah, happier, and like I seemed to be much more. I was really thriving and doing well and working and was, you know, bulimia free, which was really, yeah, a miracle in and of itself. So I think my parents were just delighted about all of that. But I wanted to apply to a coaching school, and there was one, there weren't that many available at the time, but Coach U was like one of the big coaching schools that existed then.
Yeah.
And this is like, you know, 2003.
Yeah. So definitely not like, I mean, what it is today,
early,
right?
Early, yeah. Like not now today, it's like, you know,
much more prevalent. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many more coaching programs. But anyway, back then there weren't that many coaching programs. And, but I was thinking to myself, like, I can't afford on the salary that I'm making working in production to like send myself to, you know, a coaching program.
Yeah.
So like, if, how am I going to make this work? Like my parents are not going to buy into this idea of going to like coach you.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is that? And then when I applied to, then Seligman, and I'd been reading Marty Seligman's book, Authentic Happiness, and, learned optimism. And he was sort of the guy in this new, brand new field of positive psychology. And I'd been reading a bunch of his books and was really interested in it. And the woman that the coach I had been working with at the time sent me, you know, an email saying like, by the way, they're offering this brand new positive psychology master's program at University of Pennsylvania. And I was like, yeah, Ivy League school.
Oh, there you go. Yes. Right.
This seems very legit. So I think this will work. But yeah, it was just total, just serendipitous, really. It was, wow, just really good luck.
So what, to the listener who's like, what is positive psychology? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it basically?
Positive psychology is a field of psychology. So it's just sort of like one little, there's lots of different little branches on the tree of psychology.
Yeah.
And, you know, developmental, cognitive, social psychology, you know, and so on. There's a lot, right?
Yeah.
Well, positive psychology is like one branch. And it's primarily concerned with answering the question of what is a good life? What's the good life?
Such an important question.
It's a great question. And I think for so many people who have like, you know, really achieved, worked very hard to achieve, and they assume that these external things like the right job, the right salary, the right apartment, the right marriage, et cetera, is like all of that is going to solve this problem of, yeah, what is the good life. And it is a rude awakening when you realize that that's not true.
Yeah. You get there and you look around, you're like, is this it? Oh no. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Like grab whatever that brass ring that you're trying to grab is not going to actually give you that's not what creates the good life. Right. And really it's, you know, the externals are never going to solve your problems.
Right.
Which is a tough pill to swallow. And also extremely liberating at the same time. So anyhow, this is, so positive psychology, we study, you know, positive emotions. We study positive character, so character strengths. We study optimal human functioning. So, you know, people that are like exceptionally talented, people that are exceptionally happy, we're all really interested in like in the outliers, like what are they doing that makes them like either having high, very high satisfaction with life. Also positive institutions like schools, religious institutions, government or anything that like anything that increases or enhances quality of life. Mm-hmm. And that sort of all falls under the umbrella of positive psychology. As you can imagine, it's like, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It encompasses a lot.
Yeah. So what are some of like, I'm sure that someone listening to this is like, ooh, I want to know like what the science behind that is, or like what does make someone happy? What are some of the, can you break it down in terms of like, what are some of the basic things that someone could look for in their own life to increase their happiness or to become more self-aware of maybe what they need to be fulfilled? Like, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that there are things that will make you more happy and things that will make you less happy. And some of them are very counterintuitive. And really, like one of the things that's not correlated with happiness is money, which is a really interesting thing for most people.
Yeah.
Most people think that the more money I have, the happier I'm going to be. But that's not really what the research says at all. So what the research says is that up to about $75,000 a year annual family income, money is correlated. There is a linear correlation. That means that there's a positive relationship between like the more money you have, the more happiness on a measure, you know, you would rate yourself as being happier. Up to $75,000 a year as a family annual income. After that point, it plateaus. So well-being doesn't increase beyond that point. So basically the you know, hypothesis is like your basic needs are met. In America, by the way, this would be different in another country because that would be an enormous income in
right.
another country. But for the United States, above $75,000 a year of family income, there is not, and it doesn't increase your well-being. That's so counterintuitive for
yeah.
most people.
I'm like really, I mean, I've heard that before, but it's so surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. But here's why, because what plateaus is what we call your experiential well-being. So that's like how much positive emotion are you feeling during the day? So if I was to beep you, you know, way back when there was beepers, if I was to like buzz you or text you and then said, tell me how you're feeling right now. That would be your experienced well-being.
Okay.
Right? So what emotion am I actually feeling? That plateaus after $75,000 a year annual income. However, your evaluative well-being, so that means how you rate your life, like, you know, how well you think you're doing.
Yeah.
That increases with income.
Okay.
So your positive emotion, so you're feeling good, doesn't change. How well you think you're doing, your kind of assessment of your life increases the more money you make.
So interesting.
Yeah. So basically what that means is you just have to learn to manage your thinking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like it's not really actually creating more positive emotions having more money. You just think you're doing better in life because.
Well, because you're evaluating, you're saying like, I'm doing better. So because I'm doing better, I should act in accordance to someone who's doing better? Or what's the science behind like you think about it and then you actually take actions based off of your emotion? Like, can you explain that process in general?
Well, so it's just the way your brain works. As like, you know, all models are wrong. Some models are useful. Like thinking of your brain in a sort of, it's really originally a CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy model, but essentially everything in your life is neutral, including how much money you make,
mm-hmm.
right? That's not how we're conditioned to think about it, but it is.
Yeah.
And then the external like realities of your life, the facts of your life, as they call them, they trigger a thought, right? So then your thought is what creates your emotion, and your emotion then creates your actions, mm-hmm. and the actions you take are what then create your outcome or the results you get in the world. Right. So there's this cascade from thought down to the results. So yes, if you think that your life, if you think you're doing great and you think your life is awesome, you will create outcomes that just give you more evidence that reiterate that that thought is true. And we call this in psychology confirmation bias or cognitive bias. It's just the, you're basically, because your thoughts are what are telling your mind to attend to.
Yeah.
So your thoughts are like a filter essentially of like what you are able to see.
Yeah.
So if you're telling yourself that your life is awesome, it's this bizarre thing starts to happen. You start noticing all these awesome things. When you're telling yourself that your life is terrible or you're not where you're supposed to be, that seems to be like the thought, right?
Yeah.
Not at where I'm supposed to be. Other people are doing better than me. I'm not as far along, et cetera. Like I should be more successful than I am. Then what happens is it creates the same cascade. Your thoughts create your emotions, emotions, actions, actions, outcome. And then the outcome that you get, the real life outcome you get, then gives you evidence, right, that this thought that you have, that you're not where you're supposed to be, is true.
Which is so powerful in day-to-day life, right? Yeah, like, okay. I think of that with my boyfriend where it's like, if I decide that he's amazing, I'm looking for the things to confirm that. Like, oh, of course he did that. Ah, oh, he's so great. If I'm deciding that I'm annoyed with him, it's like, oh, of course he left his boxers by the shower. Like, oh, that's so annoying that he would do that, right? Like, you're like literally looking for those things. And science proves that that's how your brain works. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've done studies like this is a really robust finding in psychology. So if, for example, if you were a smoker and you were reading an article on the effects of smoking, what they found was that the smoker, so they had smokers and non-smokers reading an article about the effects of smoking. The non-smokers, what did they had to take a test after about this article. Okay. After they read the article, the non-smokers, what did they remember? They remembered all the reasons why smoking is bad.
Yeah.
That's what they remembered about the article. The smokers, what did they remember? They remembered all of the criticisms of the findings, right? Like, so because, you know, in the way when you write a psychological paper, you're always... you're having to address like the shortcomings of the study.
Right. There's some outliers that might not fit this or whatever, that type of stuff.
Exactly. Like, exactly. They're addressing like, what are some of the shortcomings of the study? Like, here's where, you know, it could have been better. Yeah. Here's where, right. And what did the smokers remembered? The shortcomings.
Interesting.
So they're actively seeking out information that reaffirms their belief. Both of them. So if you're a non-smoker, you're actively seeking out information that reaffirms the belief that smoking is bad for you. And if you're a smoker, you're actively seeking out information to reaffirm the belief that smoking is fine.
That is so, it's so powerful that we do that. So when you're talking, when you're coaching someone or you're talking with someone who's struggling with a certain area of their life, how do you help? Like, what are those first steps that you would take with that person to kind of help them change their mindset about this or be more aware of what they're doing in their life to prove what you just even explained in that study?
So I think the first most important step is awareness, right? So I use this model, I call it cognitive coaching model, but I use this model just to help them to become aware of how their thoughts are creating this cascade of effects.
Yeah.
And just to be able to be just aware of it, right? So the first step is kind of catching these thoughts, and you're never going to notice the thought first. You're mostly going to notice the emotion. So I'm feeling really anxious. Why am I feeling anxious? Because I'm telling myself something that's making me feel anxious. Or why am I feeling irritated or sad, right? You're normally going to feel the emotion first, and then you're going to walk backwards. Like, wait a minute, what's the thought that's creating this emotion? So the first step with any client is just becoming aware that this process is even happening.
Yeah.
And that has its own magic. Like, just becoming aware that your thoughts are creating your emotions is game changing for most people, because most of us think that our emotions are created by external events.
Yeah. And right? We are not taking like control of the fact that we're creating the meaning of it, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And by the way, good or bad. So it's like something good happens and you think like, oh, that made me happy, right? No, your thoughts about that thing made you happy.
Yes. Oh, I love this so much.
Yeah. So it happens both ways. But when you begin to really, the first step is being able to see that this is happening. Then once it's happened, once you realize it's happening, then you can have some more mastery over guiding the process. Like, what's the, because I always say to my clients, I'm like, it's not so much the important thing isn't really the external goal. Like, there's a reason why we set external goals, because they create a structure to challenge us. But achieving the external goal is kind of irrelevant. What's more important is the goal thought.
Ooh, that's good.
Okay. Like, who's the person that achieves that thing you want to achieve? Someone who thinks differently than you do.
Drops the mic. Like, just throw it on the ground. That's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the real work is becoming the person who thinks the way that some, you know, who thinks in the way that of someone who can achieve that goal.
Yeah. So, right?
So the goal is to like get, is to be promoted at work. The goal is not to get the promotion. The goal is to develop the thoughts of someone who already has that job.
That's so powerful. So you're basically, when they're telling you what their goal is or what they perceive that they need to change in their life to be more happy or more fulfilled or more passionate, mm-hmm. whatever, you're like, actually, the goal gives us structure, but really mm-hmm. it's about how can we change your mindset to create thoughts that will help you become the person that could achieve that goal. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. So like, I mean, to use a work example or, you know, an athletic example, you know, let's say you're trying to start running. This is like my big bodacious goal for the rest of the year is to do a long running race. And I never really considered myself to be a distance runner for sure.
Are you doing like a half marathon or a marathon or?
I'm trying to do an ultra trail run.
Okay. So we'll you're really going for it. I love
I'm going for it.
Okay.
Like no half measures. I'm really going for it. We'll see. Like, but I just did 3 miles yesterday and was like feeling pretty pleased about doing 3 miles. So let me just be level set about where I'm actually at.
Yeah. I love your ambition. You can do it. Okay.
I'm not
cool.
Like, oh, ho hum. I just ran 15 miles. No big deal. Like, yeah. I am really starting from like the beginning here.
Awesome.
But here's what goes on. I like whine in my head about running 3 miles. Okay. Someone who is an ultra runner is not whining in their head about 3 miles.
Yeah.
Like they probably actually really love to run 3 miles. That probably feels pretty good to them.
Yep.
Right. So my work is to try. It's like, you're almost in some way, you're like method acting, right? It's like my job is to figure out like what might someone, and it really helps to talk to people who do a lot of these kind of runs.
Right? Yeah.
They already have the mindset. So then understanding like, what do they think? And most of them are like, oh, I love to run. Running is like how I, you know, manage my emotions. It's like, it makes me feel amazing. Like they get themselves to the gym with different thoughts than I do, for sure.
Yeah.
Right. But they get themselves to go out and go running with a different mindset than I do. So I'm having to work like, and then you're like taking, you know, each little thought's a thought upgrade. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, 3 miles is miserable. And then the next upgraded thought is like, I can do 3 miles. I did 3 miles yesterday. I can do 3 miles again today.
Yeah.
Right? So you're working incrementally to get to. And so then by the time I actually, and it, you know, I may achieve it in November, maybe I achieve it in a year. Like who knows? Right.
Right.
I mean, I'm going for it, but stuff happens, right?
Yep.
So you hold that flexibly. But by the time I get there, it'll be done and dusted because I will already believe that I'm someone who can do that.
Yeah.
And I already believe that I'm someone who can achieve that. So if you're thinking about like, if the goal is, you know, to get promoted or the goal is to, you know, lose weight, this is a big one for a lot of people. It's like lose weight. The person who maintains the weight that you want to be probably isn't like complaining about it all day long.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to really kind of take a hold of like, what are the thoughts in your brain? Are they serving you? Are they not serving you? It's not really about positive or negative. It's like, is this thought creating an emotion that moves me closer to my goal or not?
Yeah. That is, that can like someone just taking that basic principle, the way that you just spelled that out and applying that to anything in their life,
anything.
That can absolutely change their entire world.
Yeah. Because like people, it's the same principle. Like I want to change my body, but I hate my body. Not going to work.
Yep.
I want to improve this relationship, but I hate my partner right now. Not going to work.
Yeah. So
that like those mindsets, because of confirmation bias, they shut you down. They make no other option available to you. You can't see anything else.
This is so interesting and powerful. So do you tell, like, is there any tips on top of that? So like we're looking for catching those thoughts, right? Or more so, like you said, catching the emotion that is resulted from the thoughts mm-hmm. that we've thought that mm-hmm. and working backwards. Mm-hmm. You training for this type of a race, are you intentionally like consuming as much content in terms of conversations or even like podcasts or books from people that have that framework? Or how are you helping put yourself into that mindset?
Right. So here's what's so crazy about the human brain is that and by the way, it wasn't my belief. It was a woman who I know, and she coaches people to do long distance racing.
Yeah.
And I was saying like, oh, I'm not, I just was like, as if I was reporting the news, like Walter Cronkite, by the way, that's like one of the voices in your brain you need to pay a lot of attention to. Like yeah. I'm reporting, if this is just like a fact, I'm like, oh, I'm just a terrible distance runner.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm an athlete, but I'm not a distance runner. And she looks at me, she's like, what are you talking about? Like I can train anyone to be a distance runner.
Yeah.
And it was just that little, like that for whatever reason, that one little seed in my brain, I was like, maybe this is possible. So then what happens is your brain starts to go to work. The minute you open up the possibility, then your brain kind of goes to work for you, right? And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, and then you talk to someone else that's achieved that. And you like you find yourself in situations where you're like, you know, in conversation. Those conversations were always there. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't interested in them, right? Because yeah. I thought that they weren't related. They weren't relevant to me.
Yeah.
So now, like I'm a little more open to this idea, mm-hmm. and I can start to see more options. Like I'm like reading more articles, interested in like, you know, how do you do this sustainably? How do you train slowly? You know,
yeah,
all whatever. So then I start becoming more interested in this topic, and right, and then your brain kind of solves it for you.
And then what is that called? Where like. In science, psychological like terms, yeah. where like because now you're getting like a hit of like endorphins or excitement towards consuming that type of content, then your brain like wants to do it more, right? So now you're looking mm-hmm. for more stuff. How do you explain what that process is?
I mean, I don't even know. I mean, maybe it's like what we call selective abstraction, like in reverse, but because normally what our brain does is, you know, everybody has this experience where there's like, you know, 50 compliments and one criticism. And what are you going to focus on?
Yeah.
The one criticism.
Yeah. Right?
It's completely illogical. If you're looking at it statistically, like the one criticism is completely overpowered by the, like if you were looking at any kind of like statistical average or right.
Yep.
And we would even if we were looking at that statistically, we'd call that an outlier. Like we control for that, right?
Yeah.
We clean up the data.
Yeah.
But your brain does the opposite of that because your brains don't think logically. Our brains like patterns. We don't do logic. So what do? We focus on the one criticism. Like we actively focus on the one bad thing. But when you open it up to possibility, right? And you then all of a sudden it's like in reverse, it's happening where you're beginning to see like all, you're like, ooh, all of these possibilities kind of become available to you in a way that they weren't before. It's like you're putting on a different lens and now you can see it. Like it was always wow. there. You just couldn't see it before.
I am obsessed with your brain. Like I love the way that you articulate that too. It's so powerful. Like, oh my gosh. Thank you.
I've had this experience too where you learn a new word and then all of a sudden you hear it everywhere.
Yep.
You're like, wait, how is that even possible? It's not some weird like voodoo thing that happens. It's like though that word was out in the universe being spoken, used, and you just didn't hear it because you didn't know what it meant.
Yep.
Right? So like it completely, we call this this is very sciencey, the Velcro Teflon effect, but it's the same thing, which is when, you know, it's like it sticks to you like Velcro, or it sort of bounces off of you like Teflon. And this is essentially what confirmation bias is. So we've all had that experience where, you know, it happens to people when they're pregnant. And it's the funniest thing. When you're not pregnant, nobody's pregnant. Like, you never notice pregnant. You very rarely notice pregnant people.
Yeah.
When you're pregnant, everybody is pregnant. You're like, where did all these people come out? Like, they like came out of the dark. You're like, wait, I've never noticed this before. Like, everybody around me is pregnant. No, nothing has changed. It's just that I'm now, because I'm pregnant, I'm paying attention to other people who are also pregnant.
Yeah. That happens all the time with... Yeah. Like, we got a new car and I'm like, does everyone have an Acura, like, yes. MDX? Like, all of a sudden I'm seeing all these SUVs and my boyfriend's like, Keish, like, no, now you're just looking for them to see, like, so I can like head nod to the people and be like, we have the same car. We're going to be friends now.
Right. Like, if I was to say, if like everyone listening to the podcast, like, you know, if we're talking about yellow cars and they never think about yellow cars, then they'll go out the rest of the day and all you guys will notice will get, you all of a sudden you'll be like, it's so bizarre. There's so many yellow cars. No, they were always there. You just weren't paying attention to them. So your thoughts act like a filter of what is allowed into your awareness, because your brain is processing so much information every second that it's not conscious. It can't, because we only consciously can process like 50 bits of information per second. And your brain is internalizing like 11 to 10 million bits of information. Think about like all the things that are happening in your body right now, mm-hmm. just to keep you alive.
Right.
Like there's a whole machine at work here.
Wow.
None of which I'm paying any attention to. Right. So our brain acts as the filter through which act as the filter of what comes into our consciousness or not. So this is why it's so important to manage your thinking, because with managing your thinking and thinking on purpose, you then change the filter and you let other information in.
So powerful. And it's probably like, I mean, you've been doing this work with so many people for so long that it's like, it's so second nature, but I'm just thinking of the person who right now is in Trader Joe's that just like dropped her pepper and is like, wow, I'm going to change my whole world, you know?
But it's like, it's honestly like the magic is in the mundane.
Yeah.
It really is. It's the little things. It's like we all rise to our best self in the big catastrophes and like the big and the tough and the really tough stuff. Like it's easier for, it's just a sort of human phenomenon. Like we tend to rise to the occasion, right? So in natural disasters, like you see these people just doing these incredibly heroic things. Like we're our best self when we're faced with sort of really, you know, like the big external circumstances in our life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you know, in my 20s during 9/11. And like, that's what I saw, right? Like everyday heroes, really mm-hmm. people like, you know, being just being so helpful, rushing into danger, trying to protect their neighbor, like incredible things that people were doing because of this, you know, in the intensity of the event. But for most people, like where we're dealing with is actually the little nitty gritty mundane stuff. Like that's where we get tripped up. It's, you know, the person who is, you know, driving 10 miles an hour in front of us when we're late to something.
Yeah.
It's right. It's, dealing with a coworker who has like a particular tick that drives you nuts. It's, you know, the flight that's delayed and you miss your connection. It's like, you know, whatever the partner who like didn't fill up the gas in the gas tank, right?
Yeah.
That's where we actually get tripped up and spin out, which is so counterintuitive because it's all just so small potatoes, but that's where the real work is. It's like, if you can learn to manage your thinking around the little stuff, right? That's when your life begins to change.
So powerful. It just also just made me think of like that song. I don't even know who sings it. It's like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife.
Right. Oh, Alanis Morissette.
Yeah, Alanis.
That was my high school, you know, soundtrack to my high school, senior year in high school.
So funny, but so powerful. Okay. So before I move into the final two questions, I just wanted to see if you have a tip for like, what do you do for yourself when you're feeling like low or in a funk or like you need to boost your own mood?
I mean, a lot of things. I think that everybody should have a grab bag of things that they can do because different things, different circumstances, like different environments, different things are appropriate. But it's really, this is where, you know, when you're living an intentional life, like you've thought about, okay, stuff happens in life that I cannot control. That means like things are going to go wrong today.
Yep.
What's in my like toolkit of things that I can use to help me get out of this funk that I'm in, or like help me get over the mood that I'm in, or work through something. So, I think one thing that's genius, if you are if you have a car and you can get into a quiet car, it's to just yell at the top of your lungs. It really seems to kind of like you're feeling super frustrated. Like it's an amazing tool. You just like yell like crazy for like a minute and it sort of kind of works it out of your system.
Yes.
Again, like that's not a great one if you're like on a New York City subway. I don't recommend that one so much. But if you live in a place where you drive, I think that's really awesome. Mm-hmm. I actually got that from Ashley Longshore, who's an amazing artist, who I think is, anyway, she's an incredible woman. But she calls it scream therapy. They're making research on this. I don't know, but it does feel awesome. That's just anecdotal. I think that, you know, anything that's going to get your body moving, I think that sometimes you can reverse the model and you can use movement to change your emotion. And it just some emotion, like if you can just, sometimes you can just put on your earbuds and like dance for a minute, listen to a song you like, just kind of shake it out. I think that can be really, really helpful. Honestly, writing down the thought, like what's the thought that's making me feel sad, lonely, anxious, whatever negative, you know, whatever emotion that doesn't feel great. What's the thought that's creating it? And then questioning it, like, is this true? That I think is one of my like number one go-to tools is just doing models and like, what's the thought that I'm thinking? Is this thought helping me? Right. And our thoughts are not true. They're just letters formed into words with punctuation in our brain. That's it.
Yeah.
We make them up. Like so I was just saying, like, I'm not a distance runner. And I was reporting that, like, that's a fact. It's a completely subjective, made up opinion.
Wow. So powerful. Yeah.
So most of what we think is, we think very few things that we think are facts. Almost everything we think is a subjective opinion. So learning how to manage that is, I think, is a really important tool. But I think you can really approach it two different ways. You can go from like the neck down or like the body up to manage your emotions.
Ooh, so good. So that really...
Sorry, head down, like right.
Yeah, I knew. I was picking up what you were putting down. Yeah. So that really kind of slides into this other question where we have a Spotify playlist for this podcast. So do you have a particular jam that you want to add to the Spotify playlist? I ask every guest one of their jams, their pump up jams.
Oh my gosh, my pump up jams. That is such a good question. I mean, I think right now I've been really in like a grunge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kick major. Like I've been listening to tons of Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam and,
I love it.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Cherub Rock. Stone Temple Pilots, Cherub Rock.
Okay, that's your jam? That's what you want? Okay,
it's
cool. It's so funny because the listeners of the podcast, like, you know, listen to the actual Spotify playlist and they're like, oh, this one was so great. Like, so, yay, that's a perfect addition. And then, of course, like, everyone that really resonates with your content, like, where do we find you? How do we connect with you? Give us your rundown.
Come connect with me on Instagram. That's mostly where I hang out in the social media world. I just put up a Facebook. I was very reluctant Facebooker. I just put up a Facebook page, but I'm mostly on Instagram. And then on my website, it's all Dr. Sasha Hines. So Dr. Dr. Sasha Hines. Yeah.
Awesome. And then any last little like tidbit that you want to leave to the woman listening to this that, you know, wants to take action in her life to like build the life that she really loves. Any little tidbits you want to give her?
Oh my gosh. I think that it's a really, honestly, it's a spiritual process. Like growing into who you are is a spiritual process. I think that it's, I've really never had a client that didn't sort of like find that didn't get to that place where they were like so done with the, like, you know, pushing themselves, the grasping, the just running themselves into the ground with their thoughts, and also the way they were treating themselves, right? Like, just, I can't treat myself like this anymore. So to me, it's like, you know, if you're in that place and you're just feeling so desperate, like, I just feel like I'm in Groundhog's Day and I can't get out of it. Like, that is the seed of change.
So powerful.
Don't lose hope.
I absolutely love everything that you're about. And I'm so grateful for the work that you are doing and that you followed your gut to pursue the degree that you did. You kind of make me want to go back to school and go get a degree in positive psychology.
I love school. School's so good. Yes. I, by the way, said the, like, the avowed, like, I will never go back to school again. And I am, you know, now I'm like, are you kidding me? I love academia. I love being in a room with people who are all so curious and, like, have just this, like, a ravenous appetite for learning and understanding themselves. It's really fun.
I'm so excited that I'm now connected with you. And I'm the whole podcast community, we're just going to cheer you on when you get your race done. Because now I'm invested. Yeah. I'm just going to fly there. I'm like, hey, I'm Keisha. You don't even know me. Remember me? Totally. I love it so much.
So I'll be posting my progress on Instagram. But we'll see. Yeah, I mean, this, by the way, like, it's even saying it out loud to you, I'm like, oh my God, this is absurd. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
That's how it feels to me.
Yeah.
It's like, I may as well be saying I'm going to the moon.
Yeah. Which you could totally do that too. You're just construct different thoughts, right? Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not kidding around. Like, this is like, I mean, you know, running, who cares, but it's the process of blowing my mind, right? It's the process of being able to look back a year from now and be like, wow. Like, I did something that I thought I could never do. And I got there one thought at a time.
But there we go. That's what's up. Dr. Sasha Hines, I'm obsessed with you. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Oh, I'm so grateful for you.
Maybe my favorite thing in the world. Yeah. Geeking out on that,
so. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening. If you love this episode, I would so appreciate it if you share with your girlfriends, or better yet, post it on Instagram stories and tag me. Then I can personally say thank you for helping me get this message out there. And if you didn't vibe with it, just keep that to yourself. I'm kind of new here, still trying to figure it all out. Talk to you soon, girl.